So good afternoon, everyone. My name is Michael Berry. I am the director of the Center for Chinese Studies. I'd like to welcome all of you to our Center for Chinese Studies Scholars Forum. This is a quarterly series that we've been hosting here for a little over a year at UCLA, where we like to bring together scholars from disparate fields across the UCLA campus at different career stages, working on different disciplines to try to create new connections and really to create a community of scholars working on Chinese studies here at UCLA. So often we kind of all get stuck in our own disciplines and don't jump out of that. And this is what we're trying to do here is build a greater sense of community for all of our scholars. And so when you look at the speakers today and realize that everyone is coming from a very different area, and there's no unified theme, that is very much intentional. We're trying to mash things up and mix things up and create a little bit of synergy between different people on campus. And so it's my great honor to introduce our speakers for today. Our first speaker is Professor Nancy Levine from the Department of Anthropology here at UCLA. She has been studying the impacts of transitions to a market economy and government-sponsored land privatization on family and society among ethnic Tibetan nomadic pastoralists since 1994. This research has involved brief stays among different pastoral groups in Gansu province, Sichuan province, and Qinghai province. And in prior years, she conducted research on the impact of government reforms on family structure and domestic economy among agriculturalists in the Western Tibetan Autonomous Region. Her early research took her to Tibetan-speaking communities in Western Nepal for a total of more than 3.5 years and involved a focus on marriage and household systems and population dynamics. And our other speakers, Professor Sean Metzger and Wang Yeo, a PhD candidate, I think I'll introduce each of them just before they speak. And besides giving your presentation, in the spirit of sharing, I also want to encourage everyone to maybe say just a few words about your research in a broader context, maybe before your specific presentation. But without further ado, let me begin with Professor Levine, and then I will come back to introduce our next speaker.
Okay, so you can hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm going, it's part of the talk, I'll talk about the special challenges I face working among Tibetan pastoralists in China, but let me get going. If I can get going here, whoops. Yes. Okay, let's see. Yeah, I'm going to have to try a different presentation. Aha, here we are. Okay, so is this the first one? Oh, it's going backwards, I'm sorry.
No worries.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to go back to the beginning. Yeah, okay. So I'm going to have to start like this.
Okay.
Okay, all right, I'm trying to make this really tiny. Okay, so in today's talk, I'm gonna talk about the successive social and economic reforms that the Chinese government has been imposing on a small minority in extremely rural Tibetan areas, nomadic pastoralists, and on family life in particular. So this is where I talk about my fieldwork. It's been difficult to accomplish this, and for four reasons I cite here. One is we don't have any baseline information prior to the recent past, so it's difficult to track changes when we don't know where we're starting from. Another factor, as you'll see in the map in a second, is that this is a huge region, and there also are cultural variations for some of the reasons I'll talk about later. Across this region, the pace of change has been extremely rapid, and each time I go back, I'm sort of whipsawed by the kinds of changes unimagined the previous time I'd been there. And also for me, particularly, difficulties of access as an American working in an area which is had supporters and has been restive, as they put it. Okay, so these are the topics I'll be talking about today. Give a little bit of background on the population, where it's located, and ways of life. I'll talk very, very broadly about the policies that have been instituted by the Chinese government and some of the ways in which these policies have transformed the life of these people. I'll talk about my efforts to come to some sort of conclusions about what life was like in the past, prior to the 1950s, and how they are distorted by theoretical frameworks, which were prevalent at the time that explorers and missionaries went through the area. And then I'll try to make sense of some of the changes that families are making to their life ways in response to socioeconomic reforms. Okay, so this is a map, and this can perhaps show you how huge the area is. So I've outlined pastoralist occupied areas in green. And so the figures one gets is that the Tibetan Plateau, that is the area occupied by Tibetan pastoralists, is an area of 1,000 by 2,500 kilometers. The average elevation is over 4,500 meters, although pastoralists tend to occupy slightly lower range of altitudes. There are approximately 2 million pastoralists in this region, and in what is the higher reaches of the Qinghai Tibet Plateau, but they tend to live in the lower reaches of the high areas. And in the past, they maintained distinctive territories, and they once moved seasonally with their animals in search of forage, and that pretty much defined their lives. So this is where I've done my research in this broad area. The broad area is, of course, here. And I've been concentrated in northern and northwestern Sichuan, southwestern Gansu, and southern Qinghai provinces. And I've been there for six periods of time of varying lengths between 1994 and 2015. My next slide shows some fairly typical scenes from the early 1990s when people were trying to reconstruct their past lives and were living, as I understand it, in fairly close parallel with the ways they lived in the past. This is what a group of pastoralist settlement might have looked like in the past, certainly as it did in 1994, and what it looked like in winter. So these pastoralist populations vary a great deal, and one of the major poles of variation is the political circumstances under which they lived. Some were independent, wholly independent of outside authorities. Others were subjects of secular principalities, and still others fell under monastic institutions to whom they owed taxes and various work obligations. Regardless of that, foreign observers who passed through the region and also Chinese sponsored teams that were meant to document, to provide gazetteers of the region, invariably describe these groups as clan-based tribes. I've cut and pasted the Chinese word bulao, as I'm not sure how to pronounce it. I do not speak Chinese. I speak three dialects of Tibetan. And the use of this term was meant to convey that they were pre-modern and that their social relations were based on blood ties rather than on territory. And that those ties, as I'll say again later, were traced on male lines. And everything I've found out in the recent past throws a great deal of doubt on most of those assumptions. This is one thing about the past on which everybody agrees, that pastoralists and the lived in encampments. These were units of social cooperation consisting of 2 to 10 tent households. The families in those households were closely related or they were close friends. And each encampment was linked in others in various ways with similar groups. And this is an old photo from 1926. So this is just a sort of snapshot of reforms that you all know about this. In the 1950s, collectives began to be set up in these eastern Tibetan regions, not in the TAR. In the early 1980s, the household responsibility system took effect, and collectives dissolved and animals were distributed to member families. At that time, people returned to producing for their own household consumption. They returned to living in encampments and they moved seasonally across what was for many the grasslands that they held in pre-modern times. Then in the late 1990s, there was a series of policies supporting privatization and reducing mobility among these groups. So the government subsidized house construction, animal shelters, and fenced plots. They also divided the grasslands, they used surveyors, and they allocated parcels in the form of long-term contracts to families. One problem is that these parcels are indivisible and they can't be bought and sold. Common land holdings and grazing shared by many families is the rare exception. It only occurs in areas where there's an absence of water sources or the territory has some sort of severe ecological constraint. But by and large, people are living separately. And so this is what life is looking like more recently. Individual families living in built-in structures in winter, sometimes year-round, you can see a kind of house that these families tend to live out on the grasslands. Some people also still live in the traditional yak hair tent. They graze their area on fenced-in pastures independent of other families and use now motorized transport instead of horses to get to and from town. And this is, the government has been subsidizing and providing chain link fencing to create privatized use of privately contracted or controlled grasslands. The program of greatest consequence that is most problematic for people is permanent settlement. So holders of pastures that were deemed ecologically fragile or degraded or that have been designated national parkland, I hope I have time to talk about this later, they have to leave their, they got contracted lands and then 3 years later they had to leave them and they've been provided for housing, provided with housing in county towns and also monthly government support because they have no source of income anymore. And so this is a picture of me in front of the source of Three Rivers National Park, one of the marked source of the Yellow River, although this is not the actual source of the Yellow River. And it's a huge tract of land. According to Wikipedia, it is the land that falls into this park is slightly smaller than England. And if we have time later, I have a map showing how great an area of the Tibetan Plateau this park takes up. It's just simply huge. So other pastoralists who haven't been forced off their lands have been offered subsidies to get a house in town. And many of them decided to take advantage of what they saw as a once in a lifetime opportunity of a subsidized house, or they moved to a settlement to gain access to new jobs, new economic opportunities, because their own pastoral enterprises were failing, and also to take up mandated schooling for their children. And so you can see this is a school. Schools have been consolidated. They used to be dispersed across the grasslands, but now you just have schools in towns, and in order to follow government policy, you have to either send your kids to live on their own in town or accompany them to town. And this is an area which had not a single building on it in the 1950s, and now is one of the many new towns dotting the high plateau. And this is what one of the urban resettlement villages looked like, identical houses constructed by foreign or outside, constructed with outside companies, often poorly constructed, leading to problems of repair. And people are left there with no source of income and they're completely separated from their former way of life. So we know there've been a range of adaptations to these changes. Some families have fared better than others. And what I've been trying to get a sense of is how these changing circumstances have changed relationships in families. And in order to track change, you have to say what things were like in the past. And it's difficult to know what things were like in the past because we only have images, snapshots provided by travelers and missionaries and these government study teams and occasional ethno-historical recollections of people who were pastoralists or whose families were pastoralists in the past who've written in Tibetan and English. But this is the image that the standard picture of pastoralist life, that people traced descent through men and that local groups were organized around clans. that sons stayed homes and daughters married out, and that inheritance went from parents to their sons. And none of this seems to be true as far as I can tell. So interviews with people beginning in 1994 offer a very different picture. Clearly there were clans in a couple of areas. Clans were missing in most. Livestock were inherited equally by sons and daughters. This is absolutely true everywhere. And daughters were occasionally the selected heirs by their parents and not sons. And nowadays, what seems to be happening is that siblings are helping one another adjust to these changes. Brothers and sisters are teaming together to balance the opportunities of herd keeping where it's possible and urban opportunities where they are feasible. And one also finds these very unusual multifamily networks, single, divorced, and married individuals, often with their children. They form cooperative groups, sharing the contracted and indivisible parcels of pasture land that their parents received in the late 1990s, creating a new kind of encampment in the present day. And I have two pictures of two families that I interviewed. And this is a family network consisting of two sisters and one brother. The brother's wife is here, and one of the sisters is in the picture, and the children of one child each from the three families is in this picture. They live together in one house in town and in separate tents pitched adjacent to one another on their pastures. They have no choice but to share the indivisible contracted land that they receive from their parents. This is another picture. It's a 21-person mega family. This is the head on the back of the motorcycle, one of his sons in the front, and two of his grandchildren heading off to town. They live in one big and several small tents on their summer grazing site and share two adjacent houses in their winter grasslands and one house in town. And so it's a mega family, and it's occasioned by the indivisibility of pasture land on the one hand and by traditional customs about family sharing and networks of family relationships. So these are my conclusions. Understanding family practices requires attention to history and causes and processes of change. This is complicated when history is difficult to reconstruct and field trips for people like myself are very brief. Despite these challenges, I've come to the conclusion that Eastern Tibetan pastoralists seem to be relying on traditional values previously unrecognized in the old patriarchal oriented model of the Tibetan family, unrecognized values of cooperation between male and female siblings, rather than any quote unquote tribal or clan-based unity. And collaboration seem to be particularly common among brothers and sisters, not among males exclusively. And so this is the picture summarizing the end, only it's not really the end. On the top left is a picture of how I used to get to town when I first began studying these pastoralists and what the town now looks like. Same street, this is the exact same street, 21 years later. And this is all centered around pastoralist life, are centered around yak, which they know by a word, which in Tibetan means wealth. Okay, so this is just to give you a sense of what's happening with this national parkland and how much of a huge area that it occupies on the Tibetan plateau and the extraordinary numbers of people who have been taken off their traditional rangelands and sent to these barracks-like towns. And I do have another picture as well if we have questions about it later. So I'm going to stop sharing and give way to the next participant.
Thank you so much, Professor Levine. It was a pleasure to hear you speak. And I've only been at UCL about 5 years, but I don't think I've ever had the pleasure of meeting Professor Levine in person. And so this is exactly why we do these kind of events, to build these connections, and just so fascinating to hear about what people on and other units on campus are working on. Our next speaker is Professor Sean Metzger. I do know Sean. Sean is based in the Department of Theater, Film, and Television. He is the author of two books, Chinese Looks, Fashion, Performance, Race, and most recently, The Chinese Atlantic, Seascapes and Theatricality of Globalization, which was just published last year. His areas of research span many different fields, from theater to film, fashion, sexuality, performance, and I believe today he's going to be talking about the film Irma Vep. So I'll hand it over to Sean. Thank you so much for joining us, and take it away.
Thanks, Michael, and thank you to CCS for inviting me. I was trying to think if I've ever been invited by a Chinese Studies Center before to give a talk, and I can't remember, actually, because my research kind of sits uneasily under that rubric, although I have a kind of foot in that field, and I am very grateful for all the research done properly within its domain. If Nancy was sort of talking about transformations within China, I'm often interested in what happens when China or Chineseness leaves the nation state and travels around the world. So I suppose this is partly why my work sits outside of area studies proper often, because I'm not always interested in what happens in the nation state, except insofar as that affects transnational circulation of things like Chinese goods and products later. And that's partly because of expertise and partly, as I'll explain, my own familial background, I think. So I'm going to share my screen. Okay, so I wanted you to see what I've been doing. And as Michael mentioned, I've been working on these two books and I had just finished the second one. So I'm kind of in between projects right now. And insofar as I'm thinking about what I've done as an oeuvre in terms of my scholarship, I was thinking about how I got from Chinese Looks to the Chinese Atlantic. And I'm gonna talk about that today. So I wrote an essay that is vampiric fashion. What I'm talking about today is an essay that sort of explores that dynamic of how I move from one project to another, because Irma Vep has sort of haunted me from the time I was a graduate student to now. It's just being redone as a series by the original filmmaker, Olivier Assayas. He's doing a version for TV now with a Dutch actress this time. In any case, I wanted you to see this picture in Chinese Looks as well, because that photo is of my grandparents. And the woman on the left is my grandmother, who was illiterate in both English and in Chinese. So I guess one of the things I take to Chinese studies is an emphasis on performance studies and visual culture, because in my family, cultural transmission didn't happen through written archives. And I think from my perspective, I'm really interested in how Chineseness circulates and how it accrues meaning, but without recourse to thinking about it through a written archive, through literature, through letters, because that wasn't part of my familial experience. This is not to say that I only write about my own family, but I think I was just thinking about today how I got here. And I think that's has a lot to do with why I chose the fields I did when I started in graduate school. So I'm in the middle of a few different projects right now, but I chose this one because I think it speaks to some of the concerns that cross over a lot of the very different iterations I've done in the past several years. Let me see. I guess the other thing I would just say is, again, my work tends to look at Sino-American sort of intersection, so that is Chinese American and also the ways in the US and China collide. But more recently, I've started to track China outside of the US. And in part, that's to destabilize American hegemony. So when I started talking about globalization in more explicitly, I did so with recourse to the Atlantic world, thinking about the Caribbean in particular, and then adding in places like South Africa and England, which was new for me. But I wanted to do that because I was feeling like the discourse of US-China was becoming there was too much of the same kind of, oh, China's becoming a global power and the US is worried about it. There was too much of that. I wanted to try to move outside of that kind of paradigm. So that's what that book does. I tell my students I like them to imagine differently. And so this was an attempt to do that. In my article that's called Vampiric Fashion, Chinese Circulation, Cinema, and Clothing on Screen and Off, I talk about Olivier Assayas's 1996 film, Irma Vep. Again, this film has haunted me for quite a while. And part of it is because it showed me early on how costumed Chinese characters circulate transnationally and what circulations might, what those circulations might mean in terms of psychic and material terms. My first book was about specifically fashion items that circulated through a Sino-American interface. And then again, the second one was about Chinese aesthetics, finances, goods, and people as they inform the idea of globalization. So this essay is really a provocation in terms of my own work to think about the boundaries of life and death, that is the vampiric, in relation to Chinese circulations of clothing and representation. So just so you have some idea, the film Concern is a remake. So the director who you see on the left, the male figure, is named René Vidal, and he is trying to remake Louis Fouillade's series Les Vampires, which was a serial produced in 1915 to 1916, or released in 1915 to 1916 in France. And he wants to redo shot by shot the series, except for the fact that he wants to substitute the lead actress from the serial, who was Musidora, to Hong Kong star Maggie Cheung. And keep in mind, this was now 25 years ago, so Cheung had a different kind of career at that time. So that's really what the story is about. And then in the narrative, all the characters end up falling in love or in lust with Maggie Cheung as she's moving through different parts of the shoot. And then in the middle of the film, the director has a breakdown and the new director replaces Maggie Cheung with her stunt double. And then the film ends with shots of the existing footage that have been bleached and etched out. And they're reporting that Maggie Cheung is gonna then go to New York and then to LA. So she'll come back into France, even though she's kicked out of the French film, the products that she makes with those American filmmakers will come back into France. So my objectives for today then are just to think about the concerns that bring my two books together and then use the film to theorize vampiric fashion as a form of cultural interchange that might be productive. So I recognize that it has certain kinds of connotations about taking life, but I'm also interested in seeing what it might mean to resuscitate the undead. And I suppose it's worth saying that my work is often, I'm more of a conceptual thinker than I am an empirical researcher, although I rely heavily on empirical research. But I'm really interested in, again, how we imagine different tropes to get us to think differently about things that we think we know. So in this regard, I think the vampiric and clothing in particular is a useful vehicle to track cultural anxieties through both screen fantasy and material production. So I'm going to try to make an analog linkage there. So in order to execute that analysis, my goal is to go through four categories quite briefly. So one is the vampiric and what I mean by that. The second is the notion of revamping Fouillade. So to think through what does it mean to redo a French serial at that time in the turn of the millennium. And then what is the materiality of costume and what does it have to do with the film in the ways it's been discussed or not discussed. And then I'd kind of make a leap at the end because I'm interested in thinking of this, using the film as a device to think through a kind of conceptual framework for thinking about material fashion circulation. So I end up in Senegal, actually, looking at local shoemakers. So that's the scope of what I intend to do today, briefly. Okay, so the vampiric. My notion of the vampiric draws heavily on two scholars. One was my former colleague, Sue Ellen Case, who wrote Tracking the Vampire, which was an essay that really responded to feminist film theory of the 1980s. And she was quite interested in thinking about the possibilities for, not for visibility as positive representation, but thinking about what other strategies might there be for people who have been invisibilized by dominant structures. So I grabbed a quote from that article for you, and I'll just read it to you. It says, her proximate vanishing appears as a political strategy that is, again, against the politics of visibility. Her bite, that is the vampire's bite, pierces subject-object positions because it makes whoever she's biting into a version of herself. And her fang kiss brings her the chosen one, trembling with ontological orgasmic shifts into the state of the undead. So obviously, Sue Ellen Case is a queer theorist, was interested in mining the vampire specifically for lesbian theory. And if lesbian desire was unrepresentable in cinema at a certain moment, how would you think differently about using a vampire to restage or make visible and then invisible the vampire for political purposes? The next text I had in mind for my dialogue was Nina Auerbach's Our Vampires Ourselves, which was a popular book in the mid-90s because it sort of tracked through various vampire stories that were popular in that moment in both the UK and in the US. So I took 2 points from Auerbach, and they are as follows. First, she has this idea that their appeal is dramatically generational. That is, in other words, for every vampire, for every age, there's a different vampire. So we use the vampires to think about social construction at specific moments in time. And related to that, she says vampires go where power is. So that is, if you follow the vampire through whatever medium you're looking at, you'll get a sense of how power circulates within this particular context. So again, I find both of those cases and Auerbach's notions quite useful. For me, ultimately, Auerbach is really interested in mutability. So it's about how the vampire mutates or transforms in different historical moments to reflect that moment. And for Case, she uses the vampire to resist oppressive representational apparati, whatever. So she wants to think about if there's a structure that has deemed a certain population not worthy of life, like the queers, for example, she says, well, we can turn to the vampire to restore some kind of animation to those characters, to think differently about to think about and critique the structure that's oppressing in the first place. Neither of these scholars at the time was really thinking through race in or culture difference in their respective writings. But I think those areas of study have really come to the fore in both vampire narratives and their study, because those narratives continue to be about blood and contamination, and those inform that genre. So that's the idea of the vampiric. And the vampire then leads me to Fouillade, because Fouillade's series again is called Les Vampires, or the Vampires. So the villain that stays alive the longest, I'll say, in the Fouillade serials was Irma Vep, who was played by a vaudeville actress turned screen star named Musidora. And she became really well known in that role, specifically in her silk bodysuit. So you can see the silk bodysuit in the image I have here. I just wanted to have it's a full body suit. And supposedly only 15 minutes of the, I think, 10 hours of footage in the serial of 10 episodes features her clothed in this way, but a lot of the advertisements and the paratext around the film include visualization of this silk costume. So the silk costume then bears the weight of whatever femininity means in the moment that this was screening in the 1915, 1916, the 19-teens. So there's been a lot of scholarship on this particular serial, and most of it agrees in thinking that Musidora as Irma Vep signifies both the emergence and containment of the new woman that emerged in France at the fin de siècle, and that she transgressed social boundaries through clothing. So again, this particular outfit was how everyone came to know her in the publicity posters and things like that. But there are many, many other moments in the serial where she cross-dresses as a male, or she puts on a costume to infiltrate a bank, et cetera, et cetera. So there's all of these moments when she uses clothing to work her way into a social system that she wouldn't otherwise have access to. So the criticism then follows and says, okay, so this means that she's signifying the lack of containment or the mobility of the woman in the early 20th century, and then contains it at the end. So at the end of the 10th episode, Irma Vep is slain by the news reporter who's following her. his fiance ends up shooting, I think, or I forget how she kills her, but she ends up killing her. So basically domestic woman takes control over the woman who has too much authority in the social sphere. So again, A Sayazam Revup is about the remaking of Les Vampires with Maggie Cheung just substituted in Musidor's role, but otherwise it should be a shot for shot remake. So that necessarily meant that scholars who were looking at that remake thought of, okay, so what's the point of having a Hong Kong star or a Chinese star take over this role, which was really associated with a French national movement in cinema. And those scholarly works tend to cover things like Asian femininity, globalization, cinematic intertextuality, and again, with a focus on how China is informing or potentially challenging the notion of French cinema at the moment of the 1990s. Okay. So that brings me to the material out of costume, because I'm not interested in rehashing what other scholars have said, although I find it quite useful. But one of the things that I noticed about the film is, in addition to the actress being swapped out, the costume is also swapped out. So in the serial, Irma Vep wears a maillot de soie, which is a silk costume. And the picture here on the left is a silk factory that I'll explain in a second, but it's a silk factory in Lyon that's actually taking tours now for people who wanna see Lyon's history with silk. So the French history with silk is something I'm gonna come back to. On the right-hand side is an image from Alibaba, because I thought you should have something to look at that would be more provocative. So this is a latex item produced in China that you can order if you like. I just found it online today, actually. And I'm interested in what is the significance of the shift in moving from a silk costume to a rubber one. So that's what I'm going to talk about for just a moment. So my question was really, what are the associations, or what might be the associations with silk in the period that Irma Vep was released? And suffice it to say that Lyon became the epicenter of France and Europe's silk production as early as the 16th century. And then in the mid 19th century, or by the mid 19th century, Lyon really became the capital of that industry. And one out of every two workers worked in what was then called the fabrique. In the mid 1800s, there were worker strikes, and those helped signify the dawn of the Industrial Revolution in France and the attendant labor issues that were emerging at that time. In the 1850s and 1860s, there was a silkworm disease that was spreading around. So it basically stopped the industries in France and Italy at the time, which led to more importation from Asia, but also it led to the rise of silk industries in other countries, particularly in Japan and the US. So silk itself is the history of silk has something to do with national industries and their contestation. And similarly, and the other thing I wanted to say about silk is that it actually, foreign competition did not get rid of the industry. It was synthetics that eventually demolished the silk industry in France. But as the vampire reveals, the dead can always return. So we'll come back to that. And the rubber industry, to my knowledge, at least as far as I've been able to tell, really got going in the starting in the 18th century when rubber was brought to England, and then Macintoshes were released in the 1820s. And by the 1830s, you had a process of adding sulfur to the rubber, which made it more durable. And that process sort of increased the demand for rubberized products. So in the 19th century, those products included like bicycle wheels, which were increasingly popular, as well as condoms, which were actually reusable at this time. These are the things I learned in my research. So rubber had a history, and of course it was associated with plantations. In France, the plantations really took off in the early 20th century. So the history of rubber is associated very much with Southeast Asia, where Chinese overseers, or I guess Chinese middlemen had boss jobs in the plantation economy. As far as I've been able to tell, China itself didn't have a rubber industry until the 1950s. So that was sort of emergent. But by 1986, China was the fourth largest producer of natural rubber in the world. So I'm interested in that shift. And again, it suggests that, oh, okay, so China's coming in to challenge other industries around the world. The other thing to know about latex versus silk is latex, and this comes up a lot in the film because Maggie Cheung's costume is always having issues, is not an easy material to work with. So unlike textiles or other textiles, which are stitched together, latex is glued together. So you can either do that piecemeal and then attach things in, part by part, or you can do a full body mold. But either way, there's a lot more labor involved in this. And as the character in the film keeps commenting on this, so too did the Françoise Clavel, is the costume designer for the film. She also complained about this quite a lot, that having to do this object in rubber was exceedingly difficult, especially because of the budget of the film, because they didn't have enough money to do replacements. They could only do repairs. So like the silk, rubber also is not engaged with in terms of the original series. That's not commented on in Irma Vep, so that you never get a commentary on what it means. And actually, the filmmaker himself has never said why he wanted a latex suit, nor does that occur in the diegetic narrative, that is in the film's narrative itself. So part of what I'm interested in here is that cinema as a mode of reproduction itself depends in part on the resurrection of stars, that is Maggie Cheung for Musidora, as well as the replication of costumes, but it can never restore what's past. It can only elicit the desire for it. Okay, so I want to just move quickly to implications of that. And this is somewhat of a non sequitur, but I hope it kind of comes together in some way. So I want to briefly jump to Senegal, because Senegalese cobblers have lost sales because of Chinese imports. So basically, Chinese entrepreneurs have looked at what's on the shelves in cobbler shops and reproduce them in China for much cheaper and are selling them at a much lower price. So the sale of these cheaper goods in terms of price and quality is decimating this local artisan industry in Senegal. And so another way to think about that is as a vampiric construction, right? So China's coming in, sucking out the lifeblood of this and then reanimating the garment industry in its own image. So I'm interested again in taking that metaphor and then applying it to something that's more concrete. Well, the thing about the vampiric is it's not just that someone is suffering from Chinese intervention, but that it also facilitates a certain kind of accommodation and innovation. And so I would just point to a study of youth culture in Dakar that's looking at the ways in which people actually use these fashions. And what's happened is people, because of the quality of the goods, they're showy, so they look nice, but they don't last long. So women are going into parties, for example, young women are going into parties with Chinese footwear on, and then once they get to the party and have shown off their outfits, they're replacing them with more practical shoes made in Senegal by Senegalese artisans. So I think that's an interesting kind of moment where you see a whole discourse emerging. Again, I got these from various Al Jazeera news reports and other kinds of stories on how Senegalese cobblers were responding to the Chinese globalization. So for me, what's interesting about that is there's a potential agency in clothes as well as a kind of flexibility in the context that it's producing garments. And we know that those clothes, even like the shoes that are disappearing right now, will likely come back because fashion dies only to be reanimated. That's my metaphor is coming back again. And I'm going to stop on that note. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Sean, for a very stimulating talk that took us, well, from Paris to Senegal, and somehow we looped in China in the middle. And our third speaker is going to be Wang Yo, who is a PhD candidate in history at UCLA. At the intersection of environmental and economic history, her dissertation examines the establishment and evolution of communal water governance in early modern Jiangnan from the period 1600 through 1850. And so I'm going to turn it over to Yo to share her screen and take it away.
Thank you so much, Professor Barry, and it's definitely an honor to be here. And let me share my screen. Oops. So as you can see, I was Googling like the Maggie Cheung, and so can you see the screen?
Yes.
Awesome. So As Professor Barry says, my dissertation examines the local water governance of early modern Jiangnan, and this talk is part of it, and it's still an ongoing project, so I really look forward to your comments. So after the two wonderful talks on contemporary China, I would like to bring us back to the Qing Empire and explore a small but important region of it, the Jiangnan areas. As you can see, it's actually quite a small region given the entire territory. And geographically, Jiangnan often refers to 8 prefectures and 1 department in the southern Jiangsu province and western Zhejiang province. It's China's economic and cultural center for nearly a millennia, and today it's often known as the Greater Shanghai area, which further confirms its economic and cultural importance. Known as watery land or Shuixiang, Jiangnan and its agricultural productivity and economic prosperity heavily relies on intensive water management. However, we often heard criticisms of dysfunctional hydronic infrastructures in ponds, agricultural and hydraulic treatises, and official and private histories. In many cases, there were blames against idle farmers who failed to manage their water systems. To be fair, managing water is never easy for a community. Indeed, numerous social science studies have demonstrated that communal resource management, especially those that require large-scale coordination, face severe structural challenges. Therefore, political scientists, economists, or social scientists in general often argue that communities, unsurprisingly, especially those non-Western rural communities, cannot manage their water resources or resources in general, and so it is crucial to have the government or the market forces to step in. Likewise, histories of early modern China assert that farmers were incapable of coordinating on water governance, and the state was the only resort. Today, I will reject these assumptions through the research of water governance of Jiangnan, especially that of one river system. The Taiping River here ran about 10 miles in the Danyang County, Zhejiang Prefecture, and received water from the Yangtze River. Notably, the Yangtze River has been the longest river in Asia, and even today, it has an average flow of 1.1 million cubic feet per second. Although comes with the Yangtze water with the sands it carries, as long as the riverbed was properly dredged, the Taiping River could irrigate an area of 8 square miles with about 30,000 mu of land and benefited about 80 settlements alongside the river. As we can see, at least between 1653 and 1820, the 10-mile river was regularly dredged 13 times. All river works were under little official intervention and was a collective achievement of over 3,000 households alongside the river. Considering the structural challenges the large-scale cooperation faced and these well-received assumptions, we have to ask, how did they make it? Or how did farmers in the Taiping Basin respond to the challenges facing communal resource management and successfully manage a river that was as long as 10 miles? To partly answer this question today, I will examine the residential part of Jiangnan that facilitated the long-term inter-village cooperation. I will also explore the first hydronic reform in the basin, which especially how farmers set rules to allocate laborers and water benefits among villages. Compared with large villages in other densely populated regions, such as the South China or North China Plain, Jiangnan settlements were often small, dispersed, and often made up of people from the same patrilineal line or the same lineage. And so this is the South China or this is North China Plain. And also those large multi-synonym villages in Jiangnan also tended to further divide it into smaller settlements, while their counterparts in North China and South China turned to stay as large integrated communities. Less noticed by scholars is that even within a small single surnam settlement, people of different branches might further divide it into smaller social units, which I term multi-layered lineage identity. So this residential pattern and multi-layered lineage identity are well manifested by the Zhang lineage of the Taiping Basin. All the Zhangs here recognize a Song official as a shared male ancestor, indicating a shared lineage identity. Except for a few ritual performances, this lineage did not wear much power over social and economic life. In everyday life, despite the geographic proximity, the Zhang at different villages were perceived as distinct groupings, both by other lineages and by themselves. The further division of the Zhangs did not end at the village level. For example, in 1949, all the approximately 70 households at the single surname Shiji village belonged to 12 branches and resided in three hamlets at the north, middle, and southern parts of the village. Funerals and weddings were only attended by people from the same branch, and the three Zhang settlements within the village had little social interactions with each other. For many scholars, this special residential pattern doomed Jiangnan to dysfunctional hydraulic coordination beyond the settlement or village level. However, I tend to argue that the kinship ties allow the settlement to serve as a unit of greater cooperation. More importantly, the combination of small and dispersed settlements and proper kinship ties facilitated the communal cooperation, including collective water governance of the Taiping River. For more details, let's turn to the river works. Initiated in 1653, the Taiping River Works soon experienced a lack of neighbor in its second dredging attempt, which is in 1675. As many villagers alongside the river refused to contribute to the river work or to provide the labor. This is actually a challenge inherited in communal river works or communal coordination at large. Without the compulsory power the state or the market has, the communities could not coerce their other villagers to contribute to the shared water system. To implement this local and collective project, participating communities had to arduously persuade, negotiate, and coordinate with all benefited villages. And by 1683, after years-long painful but fruitful negotiations, the water control enterprise successfully implemented a series of rules to solve this labor scarcity. At the center of this reform was the rules to allocate laborers and also distribute water benefits. Like many communal hydraulic projects of the time, farmers in the Taiping Basin shared their hydraulic responsibilities in proportion to what they called benefited land or shouni tudi. This was regulated that every 20 mu of land benefiting from the water governance should contribute a labor. We should notice that the benefited land was actually a very ambiguous concept. Depending on how sophisticated existing water networks were and how efficiently they carried the water to the irrigation sites, the area of benefited land could vary significantly, which left great rooms of negotiation and bargaining. Here, the small dispersed residential pattern facilitated the labor mobilization in at least two ways. First, the proximity between settlements made land reclamation and land trade difficult to conceal. Secondly, the small settlements were less likely to object collective decisions, and participating communities could readily generate enough social pressures and persuade each other to claim a fair amount of labor. More importantly, the reform of 1683 guaranteed river work contribution with the elaborate rules on sharing water benefits. Generally, I interpreted the set of rules in the frame of stick and carrot, with additional arrangement to solve potential conflicts and guarantee a smooth cooperation between upstream and downstream. Let's come to the stick. First and foremost, participating communities announced the exclusive strategy to reserve the benefits of river works exclusively for their contributors, which motivated settlements to continue to contribute for public affair. The commitment and ability to match water benefits with contributions and to implement the exclusive strategies was manifested in the efforts to prevent the Lin lineage from accessing the Taiping River. So this is actually a lawsuit. It started with the lineage. So the Lin lineage resided right next to the southern end of the Taiping Basin and never contributed to the river works. After a severe drought in 1775, the Lin's found the Taiping River an increasingly appealing source of water. As a reminder, so the Taiping River was timely dredged by the 1773 and actually saved the basin from the drought. So to access the Taiping flows, the Lin's tried to destroy a dam that blocked the Taiping River in front of their villages, and farmers of the Taiping Basin were outraged. In order to protect their water benefits, people launched an extremely costly lawsuit against the Lin's. After spending over 1,000 taels of silver and at least 3 years of time, the Taiping Basin won the lawsuit and prevented the Lin's from receiving water benefits. By taking pains to reserve the water benefits exclusively for the river works contributors, the communities of the Taiping Basin motivated villagers to claim their benefited land and largely resolve the issue of labor security. And together with the stick was the carrot. The river works enterprise also required that for every two laborers a village provided, it could use one water wheel for irrigation during droughts. By linking the water well quotas with the labor contribution, this rewarding system lured capable communities to contribute even more and compensated them with higher quotas or higher irrigation capacity. And this is one of the many kinds of water wells used of the time, which I found in the Tiangong Kaiwu. And notably, underlying the stick and carrot were actually a basic assumption, which is water was available throughout the river so that all the communities were treated fairly. However, as some of us who are more familiar with river management, we should know that actually in a river system, there were often very strong potential conflicts between the upstreams, which can receive the water earlier, and the downstreams. And there were actually many hydraulic operations collapsed because of this conflict. In the Taiping Basin, the communities managed to secure a relatively even distribution of water alongside the river by regulating irrigation behaviors. During droughts, the villagers could not irrigate during the day so that the tides could reach the downstream during the evening. And also during the severe droughts, upstream communities agreed that they would suspend irrigating for 3 days with spring tides and assure the downstream exclusive access of 3 spring tides plus a fair share of the rest. The communities thus guaranteed decent water supply for all. Facilitated by the residential patterns and institutional principles regarding mobilizing labor and sharing water benefits, communities in the Taiping Basin successfully sustained a water control enterprise for more than 1.5 centuries. There are indeed more communal efforts behind, but I will not cover them today for the time's sake. Overall, with the successful implementation of these rules by 1683, there were nearly 90 settlements that contribute to the river repair of the year and afterward, which is a huge achievement, especially compared with the only 47 settlements 3 decades earlier when the river work was first launched. These and other designs provide the institutional infrastructures for the long-term water governance of the Taiping Basin till at least 1821, and with an average one repair every 13 years, and also coordination among which all under the coordination among 19 settlements and about 3,000 households each time. And all of them were undertaken by farmers with little intervention by the officials. And the focus on a single river inevitably bring up with the question, was the Taiping Basin typical, or to what extent could its success shed light on the Jiangnan water control at large? It is a little bit hard to answer. Also, regular water control was touched by many poems, biographies, and local materials in Jiangnan. These records were often brief and superficial, as shown in one record in 1910, and I will read it. Most minor rivers were dredged annually by peasant villages according to customs. Therefore, I, as many others, do not record these maintenances. You can imagine how outraged I was when I was reading this document. But while this record confirms the existence of water control regularly conducted by rural communities, it actually denies any possibilities to delineate this communal effort. And as the author justified, these quotidian practices were too trivial to be worth detailing. And it's time to go back to the assumptions that were well accepted, not only in the history of early modern China, but also even in a contemporary setting. However, perhaps we should think that if a project of the sheer size and complexity of the Taiping River works could be accomplished by the farmers themselves, it perhaps the time to rethink the assumptions which assume that self-organizing hydraulic objects failed in Jiangnan and that the state or the market was the only resort. To conclude, through the 169 years of Taiping River works, farmers or local communities demonstrate that they can self-organize and craft long-lasting institutions for water governance and alike, and that the state and the market were not and should not be the only options. Thank you so much for listening, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you so much, Yo, for your presentation and to all of our speakers. And we're going to now enter the second portion of the event, which is our dialogue conversation. I'll start off with a question, and then we'll take whatever questions we have from the audience. And also, I want to encourage our panelists, if you have questions for one another, I really want to encourage dialogue amongst all of us. Professor Levine, I wanted to ask a quick follow-up. You had some really amazing images of the physical transformation of the sites that you visit, including going from livestock to get to the place to automobiles and the buildup of cities. I'm wondering if you could share some of your insights about the human transformation, about how this technology and modernization has affected the people that you've met with and interacted there over the years. I remember visiting Tibet in 1998 and was shocked when a monk reached into his robe and pulled out a cell phone. I didn't even have a cell phone in 1998. But the rapid pace of modernization, how do you see, especially your topics that you study in terms of marriage and household systems, how have you seen those structures transform due to technology and modernization?
I think Tibetans are sort of on the lower end of any kind of technological access, so that this must have been a classy monk with a cell phone. So Tibetans have like fifth hand cell phones that they use to stay in touch with close relatives, and they have beat up old cars. But in these areas, there are a lot of Chinese business people coming in, and also a lot of Chinese tourists. As you may know, it's an attractive site for Chinese of a certain kind of cultural sensibility to travel to Tibetan regions, and it's expensive, it's rare, it's unique, and so a lot of them are doing it. And so Chinese businessmen have come in to earn money from providing food and hotels to the their compatriots, Han Chinese. There's only one way that Tibetans have gotten rich in recent past, and I don't know if any of you know about this, but it's caterpillar fungus, which is an herb that grows at very high altitudes, and it supposedly has medical and aphrodisiac properties. And so those people who are in areas which are rich in this substance have managed to get wealthy, but they don't really know how to invest the money, so that the wealth is often quickly lost. There are a lot of people who are moving to Chengdu and Xining, those with resources. But by and large, I think it's a population that finds it very difficult to access the benefits of development in modern China, because they lack language facility, most of them. They lack access to good educations, and they're mostly been on the losing end. And I've been trying to find current good statistics, and I just haven't been able to do so to illustrate things like life expectancy, years of education, the kinds of jobs that people are having. And of course, a small minority are succeeding, but the vast majority are really being left behind and dispirited and depressed by losing their livelihoods and not being able to find a new way of living to substitute.
Thank you. We have a question from Yunpu Yang for Sean. Thank you for this fascinating talk. As we all know, Irma Vep was released in 1996 and Hong Kong got taken over by China in 1997. I'm wondering how you use this film to conceptualize that convoluted political, cultural, affective relationship between this French film, the United Kingdom, and China.
Thank you for the question. I think, for me, I don't think China signifies in a stable fashion normatively. But we act as if it does. So I think when I read in the press, in New York Times or whatever, when they say China, that's supposed to mean something. And I suppose it's supposed to mean like Han Chinese, more urban oriented Chinese folks, I think. But it tends not to describe either linguistic or ethnic minorities, among other things. So for me, I like Zhang Lingyu, because she signifies in a hybrid way anyway. I mean, she's from England, right? And so she came to Hong Kong to be a model and a movie star. And she speaks English better than she speaks Chinese. I mean, she doesn't hold national signification that way. And I think that's partly why she interests me, because she's being used then by this European director in a kind of orientalist way to sort of map China onto France. And he seems unaware that that's not going to work well. So I think that's part of the complicated politics is also thinking through like, oh, well, how do individuals signify those things? I really haven't thought about it in relation to Hong Kong in the last couple of years, because there's been such radical transformation and I am a bit slow. So I'm not sure how I don't have a read on how those earlier cultural iterations or earlier sort of cultural icons that signified Hong Kong cinema of a certain moment now signify, because so much has transformed in such a short time. And I feel like I'm catching up to that. So I certainly will be curious. I think France, on the other hand, is a little bit easier because it imagines itself as much more stable. And so when it's faced with things like immigration issues, the national discourse reverts to a kind of very patriarchal nationalist kind of rhetoric that's easy to recognize and critique. So I guess I'll stop there. But I mean, it's a good question. I guess I have to think through it more in terms of the contemporary resonances of Hong Kong and France today.
Thank you. There's another question from Donald Mu. It might be off topic somewhat. UCLA has a good program and I'm curious about its program. Seeing the map in 1600 to 1800 showed in Wang Yo's presentation, the land of China had shrank quite a lot. China lost 350,000 square miles of land, including Sakhalin Island to Russia. Is there any studying of that history and its implications to modern China and Russia's relationship? Yo, do you want to take that on?
Sure. And to be honest, I'm not the expertise of the frontier history, so I'm definitely not the best person to answer this question. But actually, a recent graduate of our history program, the Xiang Chi, who is now assistant professor at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, her study actually talked about exams the frontier region of the Manchuria, and also integrating the relationship between the between China, Russia, and Japan, and also dealing with the Russian and Korean immigrants in the late 19th century and early 20th century. So there are definitely lots of studies about the Sino-Russia relationship of the time, but unfortunately, I'm not really able to give perhaps a book suggestions, but I would highly encourage you to read the Xiang Chi's dissertation or her articles on the Sino-Russian relations. And I hope this answers the questions.
Thank you. I'm wondering if our panelists have any questions for each other.
I have a question for Professor Levine, if I could. I'm just curious about, there's a lot of sort of Tibet signifies outside of China as well. So, and there's a lot of activist groups that are kind of coming in to work with local populations. And I just wonder if you have thoughts about how sort of the international or transnational networks have shaped the contemporary lives of Tibetans.
The way they shaped the activists in India are very much feared by Tibetans inside China. So the political activists are feared, and if there are contacts with them, I don't know about them, and they're very carefully managed. The way in which there's interaction is on religion. And so there are religious teachers mostly based in Sichuan and Qinghai, also in Gansu province, that are teaching widely around the world, who do get visas, who communicate fairly orthodox traditional Tibetan religion to a wider audience of foreigners, and also speak to their own population. So they're the people who have been allowed and who have been very active in communicating what Tibetans consider the jewel of their culture to a wider world, but not political activists. I think that's very carefully managed, and I think that's almost impossible to do because of excellence of Chinese surveillance systems.
Any final questions for each other? If not, I'll just end by again expressing my profound thanks to our three speakers today. I know it's week 10, it's a busy time in the quarter, and I really appreciate everybody taking time out of your busy schedules to share your research, and hopefully this will be the beginning of more dialogues we can continue in the future. So thank you all.
Thank you.
Yes, thanks.
Thank you.